Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Morbid early and ad-free. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
You're listening to a Morbid Network podcast.
Hey guys, I have to tell you about this all-in-one shake that I'm freaking loving. It's called Cachava. I love saying it. It's actually hands down the best thing that I've found to help me get all my essential nutrients into one day. Cachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics. In other words, literally everything that your body craves to feel your best. And I know what you're thinking. Something that good for me cannot possibly taste good. Wrong. That's where Cachava really earns their over 52,000 five-star reviews. It actually tastes freaking amazing. It's very creamy and smooth, and it comes together with just water. And it comes in five delicious flavors. Personally, vanilla and chai are my personal favorites, but it also comes in chocolate, matcha, and coconut acai, which I still need to try. Some people like to drink it as part of a healthy breakfast or lunch, and other people love it as a protein-packed snack before or after a workout. It's really perfect for that because it has 25 grams of plant protein per serving. Personally, I like to add mine to my overnight oats. I add a scoop and I mix it all up to get a little more protein into my oats. And literally, I can have that for breakfast and feel satiated, nourished, beautiful, functioning, all throughout my day. It's incredible. Please send me more of it because I love it so much. It makes me feel very, very good. And guess what, guys? Cachava is offering our listeners 10% off for a limited time. Just go to cachava.com/morbid, spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com/morbid. Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the US with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the US? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Whatever you're interested in, they have it for you. Find the perfect fit for your climate and space. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. And along with their 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, they offer free plant consultation forever. I love Fast Growing Trees because Drew and I love gardening and stuff like that, but we always forget to run our little errands on the weekend where we go to the nurseries and say, I'd like that tree over there, please. But instead, I can just sit my booty on the couch, type in fastgrowingtrees.com, and get whatever plant I want. I just recently ordered a lemon tree because, mama, when life gives you lemons, you can make lemonade and lots of delicious lemon-flavored desserts, which I'm excited about. And it's going to get to my door in 1 to 2 days, and then I'll have so many lemons. This spring, they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code MORBID at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code MORBID at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code MORBID. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Hey, weirdos, I'm Ash.
And I'm Elena.
And this is Morbid.
This is Morbid, and we got even more soundproofing equipment. Oh my
God. I know. We got like this cool, like, foamy thing in front of us. I can't see anything though, and it feels weird.
I know, it's so weird to be like professional.
It's like we're in our own personal miniature sound booth. It's like a sound booth for ants.
It is a sound booth for ants.
For ants. Did you see the latest episode? Because this is now a Vanderpump Rules podcast.
Love it.
It's not. But did you see the latest episode where Katie quoted Zoolander?
I did.
I thought of you.
I love that. I appreciate that. I love Zoolander.
It was such a niche reference.
Funny to this day.
Funny.
And as soon as I see David Bowie say, it's a walk-off, I'm over. I'm done. I'm deceased. I made a weird noise. We watched it recently, John and I.
Did you?
Because we just were like, we need some Zoolander in our life.
Yeah.
I just really wanted to see Alexander Skarsgård yell orange mocha frappuccino.
You could have just started at, stopped at
You could have just stopped at Skarsgård, but I needed to see the orange mocha frappuccino.
Orange mocha frappuccino!
And then the gasoline fight, the best.
And then,
But as soon as David Bowie came on the screen and it goes, "Let's dance," in the background, I squealed. And John was like, "I've never heard that sound."
He was like, "I really don't from you. Know how to like, feel about
are
this.
Are you all right?
What's going on?"
I was like, "He's just so handsome." It's and like, he was so handsome in that era.
Oh my God, I know. He was so handsome all over the place.
He was.
It's like when you cried at The Last of Us and none of us knew what to do.
Yeah, guys. I don't know. If you're not watching that show, I was like against it because I'm so, I don't know, apocalypse stuff like stresses me out.
At this point, everyone and their mother is telling me to watch it. I mean, my mother, Jonathan Van Ness, told me to watch it.
Right. So. Jonathan Van Ness told you that you have to.
I know.
That's the thing. It's one of those shows that I was really like, no, I don't want to get into this because I don't want to get into an apocalyptic one. I watched the first episode and I was like, this is all right.
Yeah.
Because I was being a dick.
Like that's just, like the first time I watched Zoolander.
Yeah, I was just being
a dick.
I
just wouldn't watch it.
Then I watched the second episode and I was like, well, fuck, now I care about these people.
Mm.
And by the third episode, I was ugly crying and aww. Snot was running down my face.
Is the third episode that episode?
Oh, yes. And I was threatening John. I was literally sitting on the couch being like, I cannot fucking believe you made me watch this.
Can confirm.
Because John had watched it before me.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew what was happening. And so he filmed me.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll post it at some point just because it's hilarious.
I know. Elena like doesn't cry. So it's really funny to see that.
So it would be pretty funny. You know what? Maybe I'll post it.
Maybe I'll post it.
Because it's pretty funny, I will say. I had real emotions. And I know a lot of people don't think I have real emotions. So I think it would be good for people to see.
No, you do have real emotions. I've seen so much of them recently.
They happen.
I've seen them.
You've seen them.
I've seen them.
I've seen some emotions. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Emotional baby boy. Emotional man. You know
well,
that?
I think, are you referring to the emotions that I have for the new?
Yes.
New additions.
Yeah, and then I was saying the front bottoms, but I was just wondering if we could talk about your family.
New additions.
Yeah.
No, I am not pregnant. But
I was so... What? Wait, why did I think you were pregnant the other day?
Because I said I have some news.
Yes.
John and I have some news.
She said, I'm not pregnant. And I almost shat myself because I have a couple more years before Bibis. And I thought you could hold me over. And you are, just in a different way.
In a different way because it's been over a year now since we lost our beloved Bubba.
Mushka
our beloved
baby.
Bailey. And we had these two little red fox Labrador puppies fall into our lap.
Born on Bubba's birthday.
Born on Bailey's birthday. And we had 365 days of the year. And they were born on Bailey's birthday. If that isn't Bailey sending those dogs to us, I don't know what is.
And they say that, like, your next dog or your previous dog sends you your next
dog
or dogs.
Now I'm fully convinced.
That's
crazy.
We
were shell-shocked when we found that out. And we were like, they're ours. We have to have them.
And we found out about them, like, in the almost wake of a tragedy.
Yeah. So it all kind of lined up. And they're two gals.
Are you going to say their names?
Yeah.
You gotta.
We got Sydney.
Hello, Sydney.
The Sydney Prescott. And now every time I see her, I can say, I always had a thing for you, Sid.
And she does.
And I do. And the other one is Blanche.
And Blanche is a wily little bitch.
Blanche Devereaux literally. Is really... She's a feisty one.
Elena was like back and forth with names. And when she was going to get them, I texted and she was like, oh my God, I got them. And I was like, what are the names? And she was like, you have to wait because one of them I want to tell you in person.
And it was Blanche.
So I knew one was Sid. And then I was like, what is this other dog's name going to be?
Miss Blanche over there.
And I love them both.
They're beautiful.
I would jump in front of a moving train already for them.
Yeah, truly. Like immediately I was like, well, I would lay down my life for you guys now too.
Yeah,
so.
She literally said that.
So here we are. Now I just love two other things in my house more than anything in the whole world.
In the whole fucking world.
So we're very happy over here. It was a puppy-shaped hole in my heart that I didn't want to fill right away. But
no.
Then I think Bubba was like, girl, it's time.
Girl,
I'm sending you these babes.
She's like, girl, treat yourself.
Treat yourself. And I said, okay.
Yay.
So I'm very happy.
They're so perfect.
We have some pups. So Sid and Blanche are going to be part of the crew now.
I keep calling Sid city girl.
City girl.
But it sounds like city girl.
Like not a country girl, but a city girl.
But I'm really like city girl.
I love it. And my littlest one calls Blanche Branch.
It reminds me of Trolls.
I love it.
Is that his name's Branch?
Yeah, Branch.
Yeah.
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 But yeah, so that's the good news. And that's making us really happy. And it's given us, you know, animals just give you a little boost.
Oh my God. 100%. They really do. I was in a state of straight up depression the past few weeks.
Yeah.
And then you had them and.
And they just give you kisses.
And also, I mean that when I say that. Like, I was literally actively depressed.
Yeah, like, don't, you know.
Sometimes people get mad at me when I say I have a manic moment, but I like actually have manic moments.
And remember that you don't know everyone's diagnoses.
Yeah.
Just because you hear them talk every once in a while.
I don't talk about my little menti bees and my little problems. Doesn't mean I don't have them.
Yeah, like people tend to get mad at Ash for saying that. And I'm like, yay, you don't know what she's diagnosed with.
You're like, I have literally seen her in a manic moment, and boy, is it something.
So I think just know that. Just understand that we don't share everything.
Exactly.
So there's pieces of us that people don't know.
All
and
the
it's
pieces.
not real cool to assume that you do know. So pieces just like we're not going to assume we know everything about you guys, because we don't, even though we're friends here.
Yeah, of course we're all
friends.
We're
all friends here, and that's why we're being real with you.
Just a little sit down. I mean, I did just sing Ashley Simpson to you.
That's true.
I wasn't even lip syncing.
But you know what, guys? We all have new pups. This is all our new pups. Sid and Blanche are here to stay.
I fucking love them.
So get ready, world.
I know. And then I get like both fills because I come here and I get my dog fill. And then I go home and I get my cat fill. And I'm just living life.
Just living.
Just as my good girl would say, sliving.
All right. So I think we should jump right into it. I think it's enough chit-chat.
Enough chit-chat for today, baby.
Enough.
All right. Well, today's case is very sad. It's a very tragic case. It was requested a ton in our folder, though. That's why I ended up doing it. Yeah. Like, you guys know, we usually try to stray away from, like, kid murders.
Oh.
Yeah. This is a teenager.
Oh, man.
And it's a really sad story, but I think it's an important story to tell, obviously. And again, highly requested. So we're going to start out on the afternoon of March 3rd, 1989. Kellyanne Tinyas was at home. She was babysitting her 8-year-old brother, Richie, and the phone rang. And Richie answered, and he spoke to the person on the other end of the phone very briefly, and then handed off the phone to his sister, saying it was somebody calling for her, and they were named John.
Okay.
So she had a quick conversation with the caller on the line, and then told her brother that she was heading out to go to a friend's house down the street, and that she would be right back. That was around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but Kelly never did come back. So let's talk about who Kelly was and kind of where she came from and her family a little bit.
Okay.
She was from a pretty typical working class 1980s Long Island family.
Long Island.
Her father, Richard Tinyas, owned and operated Victoria's Auto Repairs. It was a small auto restoration business in their hometown of Valley Springs. And his wife, Victoria, who it must have been named after, she split her time as a medical assistant and a receptionist in a local doctor's office. They had those two children, 13-year-old Kelly and 8-year-old Richie Jr., and the whole family lived in a modest Cape Cod-style house located on Horton Road, and they lived with Richard's elderly parents.
Okay.
Richard's parents had bought the house back in 1967, but as they were getting older, they needed more care and support, like, for themselves and for the house, which they were able to get from their son and his wife and the grandchildren. Really, like, tight-knit family.
Yeah.
And the community on Horton Road in 1989, it was also a super tight-knit community. It was perfect for them because pretty much all of their neighbors were also working class and everybody really looked out for one another.
I love that.
They were super tight-knit, like I said, very actively involved in each other's lives, sometimes to like a surprising extent. A woman named Evelyn Neves, I believe is how you say the last name, wrote in an article for the New York Times. It was like a working class commune. The 19 families who lived on the street knew one another's in-laws and watched one another's kids. The 27 school-age children acted like cousins.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's like the perfect kind of spot to raise your kids.
I was going to say, that's the dream.
Yeah, you would think. Now, unfortunately for Kelly, she was older than most of the children on Horton Road. Most of the kids were closer to her brother Richie's age. But still, she would play with the younger kids, she would set up games to do with them, and she was definitely one of the more reliable babysitters in the neighborhood. And because her parents both worked, she really had a lot more responsibility than most kids her age. She cared for her brother, she cared for her grandparents while her parents were at work, and a lot of times she would take responsibility for Brutus, the family dog.
Brutus.
I know, I fucking love that name. Brutus. But she took it all on and she never complained, not to her parents, not to her friends. She just was there to help.
She's just a good kid.
Really was. Never wanted to complain about anything. And she always just seemed to maintain what people described as her warm, generous, and outgoing disposition. And she just like looks that way. She was a little cutie.
Yeah.
Now her family knew her as a quote unquote responsible, level-headed daughter who was, like I said, reliable, honest, hardworking, and also very well organized when it came to school. Now, even though her responsibilities at home had increased, especially when her grandparents' health kind of started to decline, she still actually managed to carve out time for herself, obviously, which she spent ice skating, which was her favorite thing to do, or spending time with like a few close friends that she had in the neighborhood, including her close friend Sharon Stonnell, who lived a couple houses away.
Okay.
Now,
she's so cute.
She's like,
looking
adorable.
At pictures of her, I'm like, stop it.
Such a little 80s girl,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, she really is. She's like the quintessential 80s teen.
Yeah, she's got that perfect
yes,
80s, like,
a bang.
Like, bang, exactly. Yep. It's almost like a poof bang.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the close-knit supportive nature of the Valley Stream community made it a nice place to live, and it also had relatively low crime rates, which was awesome, because obviously New York City was nearby and full of all kinds of crime.
Yeah.
But in Valley Stream, there actually hadn't been a murder since 1977.
Wow.
And that was when a teenager was killed in a random attack. But since that murder of 16-year-old Richard Lesser, the residents of Valley Stream had carried on free mostly, almost entirely of violent crime. But obviously that all changed this afternoon in March of 1989. So this day, Friday, March 3rd, 1989, started out really like any other typical day for the Tinyas family. Richard picked Kelly up from school that afternoon, not out of the ordinary at all, drove her home. Winter was winding itself down, and Kelly was really hoping that she could go ice skating with some of her friends, especially because there weren't going to be that many more opportunities to do it because, again, spring was coming.
Yeah.
But her dad had some errands to run, and he needed Kelly to watch her brother until her mom got home from work later that afternoon. Now, she didn't know it, but she was actually going to have a bit of a surprise party that afternoon. Her mom and her best friend, Roberta Goose, had been working together, and they were gathering up a small group of Kelly's closest friends to take her out for her 14th birthday.
Stop.
Which was just 2 days away.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. Like, literally.
Oh.
So sad. So when she got home, she grabbed the phone, which, you like, so relatable. Like, the second you get home, just, like, picking up that phone and calling whoever you can call.
Remember that?
Yes.
Remember picking up that landline?
I was going to say a chunky old landline.
Stretching that stretchy cord as far as you could go.
Yep, I loved that. Oh, the best. Now, so she called her friend Jennifer, but Jennifer wasn't home and there was no answer. So instead she called her dad and she was like, please, can I go ice skating? Like, I really just want to go with my friends. And he was like, girl, I just told you you got to wait for your mom.
Girl.
She'll be home in an hour, direct quote. No, obviously not. So she was disappointed, but she was like, all right, like, I'm not getting out of this. So
yeah.
I got to do what I got to do. Let me make some more calls.
More calls on the landline.
More calls on the landline. So she called up another friend and they chatted a few minutes before hanging up. And actually, just a few moments after she put the phone in the cradle back again, that's when it rang again. And that's when Richie answered the phone to this John caller.
Okay.
Now, according to Richie, after identifying himself, the caller asked to speak with Kelly directly. Now, after speaking for a good couple minutes, Kelly hung up, and about 20 minutes later, she told her brother that she was, quote, going to her friend Nicole's house just down the street and would be back.
Okay.
Now, it was, like, Kelly leaving her brother alone when she was supposed to be the one watching him was weird. It was really out of character.
Yeah,
for her.
Seems like it would be.
She was usually, as we know, like, I just spent the first couple minutes saying this, a very reliable and responsible girl. She's also 13.
So that's why when she didn't come back after 5 minutes, though, Richie actually ended up leaving the house and going to look for her.
Oh.
Because he's like, wait a second, like, she wouldn't leave me that long.
And did you say how old he was?
He was eight.
He was eight. That's what it was. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So he goes out to look for her, and he went to Kelly's friend Nicole's house at about 3:15. But Nicole told him that Kelly actually hadn't been there and that she wasn't expecting her.
Oh, man.
So maybe she fibbed about where she was going.
That must have been terrifying for him, though.
Yeah. And it only gets, like, scarier.
Oh.
So Richie went along, and as he walked, he ran into another boy in the neighborhood, Harry Finney, who was playing in his yard. I feel like you can picture this all so well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I feel like you can see this neighborhood in your head.
Oh, yeah.
So Richie told Harry, I'm looking for my sister. Like, have you seen her? Now, as luck would have it, Harry actually did see her just a few minutes earlier as she was headed into the family, or the, excuse me, as she was headed into the home of the Golub family.
Golub, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. We just looked it up. I've been saying it one way in my head, so I was like, oh my God, don't say it that way.
And the way that you were saying it was the way I read it too. So
yeah.
I hate when you get a pronunciation so in your stuck. Own head and then you find the real one and you're like, well, shit.
Exactly.
My head is going to say the other one.
Yep. So Golub. Yep.
Golub.
So the Golub family, they lived next door to Harry.
Okay.
Are you the kind of person who loves a touch-up on the go, or maybe you're a full glam while in the carpool kind of human? Maybe there's no time for a full face in the morning between kids, pets, work, all of that. Maybe you woke up late. Well, Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation is perfect for those moments when life moves fast. I absolutely love this foundation because it doesn't settle into any fine lines or wrinkles, and you can just toss this thing in your purse. You say, oh my gosh, I have a little smudge right here. Let me fix it really quick. It's perfect. And it's now in 16 shades. It offers SPF 20, which, like, that's amazing. It's got moisturizing pro vitamin B5. And I love the applicator. It's a blurring sponge. So you can just tap, tap, tap it to reset your foundation. And you are good. Shop Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Late nights at work taking a toll on your skin? Do you find yourself staring at those dark circles in the mirror? Well, it's time to meet your new best friend, Dark Circle Defense Balm from Lumen. Lumen is a line of brilliant men's skincare solutions crafted especially for men who want to look and feel their brightest. Whether you're a seasoned skincare pro or a total newbie, Lumen Skin has got you covered. Lumen's Dark Circle Defense Balm is a lightweight gel that absorbs seamlessly into your skin to brighten your under eyes and instantly plump dehydration lines. It's basically an espresso shot for your eyes. The best part? Lumen will let listeners of this podcast try the product out for free. Yes, you heard that right. Free. Head to lumenskin.com/wondery and get your free trial of Dark Circle Defense and their other amazing products now. Say goodbye to tired-looking eyes and say hello to a new and refreshed you. Don't wait any longer. Your skin will thank you. That's lumenskin.com/wondery for your free trial.
So Harry and Richie went to the Golub's front door and they rang the bell, but nobody answered. So Harry just went back to his front yard and Richie returned home and figured, you know, Kelly will be back soon. This is unlike her, but I'm sure she'll be back.
Poor Richie.
So when he got back at home, he did call his dad to say Kelly had left him alone and had said that she was going to see a friend, but had actually gone to the Golub's house. Now, he explained that he had knocked on the Golub's front door, but nobody answered. So Richard told his son, go back up to that house and, quote, beat on the door and call out for your sister.
Oh, man.
So he was already feeling,
yeah,
like, nervous about this.
Alarm bells were already going off.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm so stressed out for this family.
It's horrific. Ugh. So after he hung up, Richie looked up the Golub's number in the phone book and tried to call the family several times, but he never got an answer. So he went,
eight.
I know. And just like picturing him like pulling out the phone book and being like, okay, like I have to figure this out.
Oh.
So he started banging out. So after he looks up and calls and doesn't get any answer, he goes over to the house and just starts banging on the front door, calling out Kelly's name, but not getting any kind of response. But at the same time as he's doing this, he can hear loud music coming from inside of the house.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So he assumed that someone was home and just couldn't hear him.
So since he didn't get any response at the door, he just started pacing on the sidewalk.
My God, this poor child.
Calling out to his sister, and he was saying that the dog had gotten loose and he needed help. That wasn't true, but he knew that if Kelly thought that the dog had gotten out, then she would come out from wherever she was.
Like
that,
move.
Exactly, that would get her to move.
Oh,
but still getting nothing.
This poor baby.
I know, both of these poor babies.
Seriously.
So after waiting a little while longer, just pacing on the sidewalk, he went back home and waited for his mom.
Oh.
So Victoria returned home a little after 5 p.m. and she was really surprised to find out that Kelly still hadn't come back home. It was, again, very, very unlike Kelly to be any kind of irresponsible. So it hadn't quite raised alarm bells just yet, but the fact that Kelly was still missing was puzzling. Like, they were like, this is weird.
Yeah.
So Victoria started calling around to Kelly's friends and figured she'd find Kelly with one of them. But nobody in her circle had seen her since she left school early that afternoon. So Victoria keeps calling whoever she could think of, and Richard joins in too when he gets back, but they're getting like radio silence or just like no helpful tips at all.
Oh man.
No one had seen Kelly. Now it got to the point where Victoria is getting more and more concerned. So she starts going door to door being like, is Kelly here? Have you seen Kelly? Like, had anybody seen her? So she gets to Kelly's friend Sharon Stonnell's house, and Sharon told Victoria that she had seen Kelly earlier that day. And just like Harry had told Richie, Kelly was going into the Gollops' house down the street.
I'm so stressed out right now.
I know. So after several attempts to reach anybody at the Gollop house by phone or in person, Richard finally got through to the mother, Elizabeth Gollop, a little after 6 p.m., but she said that she had been out afternoon, and as far as she knew, Kelly hadn't been in their house at all that day. Oh God. So the dad, Richard, is really frustrated, seeing as all roads seem to go back to the Gollop's house, but now they're saying they haven't seen Kelly.
Like, it's like, no.
Where the hell is she?
Oh my God, he must have wanted to barge into that house.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine.
I can just feel it for him.
It's like on your street. Like, and you are looking at that house. It's your neighbor, exactly. You want to just like break down the door.
Yeah.
So he was frustrated, being like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And seeing as all roads were leading back to that house, he asked if he could speak with John Jay. John Jay.
Uh-oh,
the Gollop's 14-year-old son.
God, John's. What is going on?
I know. But John Jay, he said he hadn't seen Kelly in a few days, actually. So okay. Richard didn't press the boy any further. But he did sense a nervous tone in John Jay's voice that suggested he was not being entirely truthful.
Oh, good.
So the rest of that evening was spent searching for Kelly, going from one friend to another, just desperately hoping that their daughter was hiding out somewhere, nervous that she was going to be in trouble for walking out on responsibilities, like just holding on to any hope they possibly could. Now let's talk a little bit about the Gollop family. Most of the families on Horton Road were like actively involved in each other's lives and community events, and they all kind of engaged with each other. But the Gollops were among a small group of neighbors who, even though like they were polite enough, they preferred to keep to themselves.
Okay.
The father, John Gollop Sr., he ran Getty Gas Station in town, and he didn't really like to hang out with the neighbors. He didn't like to go to block parties, barbecues. He just kind of kept to himself and worked on his car or his boat.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, his wife, Elizabeth, she was a little bit more active in the community and more familiar with the neighbors, but she liked hanging out with her own friends and acquaintances at church or at the Keystone Yacht Club. That was her kind of deal.
That was her gym.
Yeah. So the family had moved to Horton Road a little over 20 years earlier, actually, and that was all there was to it.
Okay.
Now, the Gollops had three children. Adele was their oldest, and she had gone off to college, married, and started a family with her husband in Manhattan. So she's not really a player in this at all. Then there was 21-year-old Robert and 14-year-old John Jay. They both lived at home still with their parents.
Okay.
In 1989, Robert was an unemployed bodybuilder. He had graduated high school but didn't want to go to college and was just kind of living at home.
Okay.
Yeah. He spent his time at the Maximum Health and Fitness Center, where he would, quote, often put in up to 3 hours a day at the gym.
Cool.
Like, that's a little excessive, bro.
Yeah.
He was 5'3", so he was very focused on looking as big as he possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
And aside from the gym, he would just be at home in the family's basement or working on his tan at the nearby Tan Your Booty.
This all sounds incredibly healthy. I don't see anything wrong with it.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
I love that that place is called Tan Your Booty.
Tan Your Booty.
Like, imagine opening a business called Tan Your Booty.
It's literally just like, tan your butt.
Tan your butt.
Tan your ass.
Should have named it that. Missed opportunity.
Right?
Now, like his brother, 14-year-old John Jay was rather unremarkable, to be honest.
Yeah.
He was a freshman at in high school, but most of the time he skipped class to smoke weed with his friends.
Cool.
Yeah, like, awesome. Relatable. But
relatable.
In general, he was known to the neighbors as a troublemaker, and he definitely was not the sort of person that anybody expected Kelly to be hanging out with. It was weird that she was even at the Golubs' house in the first place.
Hmm.
But for some reason or another, Robert, the older brother, he was under the impression that Kelly and John Jay were dating, actually.
Oh.
He later told police, I saw them on the block. I could tell. I could see it in their eyes.
Whoa.
I was like, are
damn.
You?
Damn. Like that's impressive.
Like, I don't know about that.
I can see it in their eyes.
From down the block.
Like, shit. Okay.
Yeah. But no one in Kelly's family or any part of her friend group had any idea or knowledge that she was dating John Jay. Hmm. And as far as anybody really knew, they barely even knew each other.
That's strange.
Weird, right?
Well, yeah, that's very weird.
I don't know if maybe it was like a thing where they came from different friend groups and maybe they did have crushes on each other.
Yeah, maybe that absolutely could have happened.
I don't know enough to say one way or the other. That's kind of like an inference that I made based off of everything I read. But because I just don't know why Kelly ended up in the house that day.
Yeah.
And it seems like John Jay is the one that called because the caller was John.
Yeah.
Unless Robert called and said he was John, that's entirely possible.
That absolutely could have happened.
But with John Jay's nervousness, I'm like, so you invited her over and now you know she's missing? Like,
yeah.
What did you see? What didn't you
see?
That's
the thing. It's like, are you nervous because of that? Because you were the one who did the inviting? Or are you nervous because you know mm-hmm. that somebody used your name and it's your brother?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, as far as the neighbors knew, the Golubs, that's how I was reading it in my head.
See, I was going to say that's how you were reading it in your head.
That's how I feel it was. That. The Golubs, as far as anybody knew, they kept a nice and neat, tidy home, but they only ever saw the home from the outside.
Oh.
When the police did eventually make their way inside of this house, they found it cluttered with debris that officers and other witnesses would repeatedly describe as clutter, clothes, knickknacks, and trash filling every room of the house.
Ew.
Like, it was essentially like a hoarder house. But, like, there was, like, trash and
that just stresses me out so much.
And it's really sad because, obviously, like, that's a mental illness. Like,
yeah.
That's where that all stems from. But, like, the kids having to live in that environment.
Well, that's the thing. It's like there's kids and then, like, I'm thinking about
Kelly
in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a lot of it's just like adds to the stress of everything.
And it was a far cry from her home.
Where she had grown up.
Right. So Richard and Victoria, they spent most of that Friday evening, like I said, making calls, walking around the neighborhood, looking for Kelly, just panicking more and more as every hour passed. The next morning, the search for Kelly continued. Richard revisited all the places he previously looked for his daughter, including the Golubs' home. And wait, the Golubs' home. Christ.
Oh, it's so hard. No, I'm not faulting you at all.
It's when you read it in your head.
I've done that so many times.
It drives you nuts. The Golubs' house. And when Elizabeth Golub invited the family into the foyer of the home, Richard and Victoria were actually shocked by the mess that just stretched from one room to the next.
Damn.
Richard explained again that several people had seen his daughter go into their home the previous afternoon and no one had seen her leave.
So Elizabeth, that's a problem, my guy.
Yeah. So Elizabeth was like, I'm sorry, like I was running errands. I really did not see Kelly here, but let me go wake up John. So she wakes up John and he said, nope, I haven't seen her in a few days. So they were completely out of options at this point. And Richard and Victoria had to return home and call the police at this point to report Kelly missing.
Break my heart.
Awful. A call you never, ever, ever,
ever,
oh,
I can't even
ever
fathom it.
No. So Thomas McVetti of the Juvenile Aid Bureau of the Nassau County Police Department, blah, 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 he was the first one to see the case come in, and he returned Richard and Victoria's call. Now, after doing the usual due diligence in cases of missing children, calling friends, checking the usual hangouts, yada, 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 he went to Kelly's house on Horton Road. And he sat down with Richard and Vicky and went through all the usual questions. Again, explaining, you know, sometimes kids take off for a while, but they usually return.
The classic.
The whole nine.
The classic.
And Victoria was like, no. She literally said, not Kelly. Kelly doesn't do this.
Yeah. Parents, a lot of parents do know their kid.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Now, Richard and Victoria explained that several neighbors, again, had seen their daughter go into the Golub's house around 3:15 the previous day. But nobody in the Golub house says they saw her. So what the fuck?
How?
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Now, they also explained that as far as they knew, their daughter had no relationship with anybody in that house. And as far as they knew, again, no reason to go in there in the first place.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense to me.
No. So McVetty and his partner left their house and started in the direction of the Golub's home. But as they came up the walkway, they actually were stopped by Elizabeth Golub and John Jay, who were just leaving Sharon Stonnell's house.
Hmm.
Now, inside, like, so they eventually made their way inside to their house.
Yeah.
The detective sat down with Elizabeth and her younger son and started to explain why they were there. Now, John Jay told the detectives that he did know Kelly, but again, didn't see her the previous day and couldn't think of a reason why she would come to their house.
Okay.
Weird.
Yeah.
So McVetty asked if anybody else was in the house that they could speak with at that point. And John Jay disappeared for a moment and then came back with his brother, Robert, who was accompanied by like a random friend.
Hmm.
Now, Robert told the detectives he knew who Kelly was, but hadn't seen her in quite some time. He said he'd been home all day the previous day and that he just played video games with his brother and two of his brother's friends that afternoon.
I don't believe you.
And then he said, after they were finished playing video games, John Jay and his two friends left to play basketball. And Robert stayed back. Now, McVetty, the detective, he was like, I don't know, like something about this kid. He seems nervous.
And something's off here.
And he noticed that every time Robert would answer a question about the previous afternoon, he would subtly look at his brother, almost like he was trying to confirm what he was saying. So the detective just came right out and said, why do you keep looking at your brother?
I love that.
He goes,
good.
Why not just answer the question straight without help?
Make him answer it.
Mm-hmm. So they finally separated the two of them. And after doing that, the detectives left the house and went across the street to talk to Sharon Stonnell. Now, Sharon said, yep, I saw Kelly the previous day. I saw her go into that house. But this time they learned that Harry Finney, who had also seen Kelly go into the house, told Sharon it was John Jay who opened the door and invited the girl inside.
Ooh.
So John was lying. He had seen her.
I honestly was thinking like, all right, maybe he hadn't.
I was burying the lead a
little bit. You were, because I was really thinking he was maybe just nervous because he knew what was going on but hadn't seen her.
Mm-hmm. Mm. He saw her. I don't know if he saw everything, but he saw her.
Mm.
It's hard. I'm going to ask you what you think at the end.
This is just terrible.
Yeah, it's horrific. So up to that point, McVetty had no reason to believe that anybody was lying to him, but this new information suggested that no one in the Golub house was being truthful at all.
Oh, man.
So he called for backup. He explained the situation to his supervisor, and he said he wanted to search the Golub home, and he said, I believe that's where the investigation is.
Oh, man.
So under normal circumstances, the search would have required a warrant, which, as we definitely know, it would have taken some time to procure. But wanting to be, thankfully, as helpful as she could, Elizabeth actually consented to a search.
Wow.
Yeah, so.
So she really had.
I don't think so.
Absolutely no idea is what it sounds like.
No, I don't think she did at all.
Yeah.
So she invited the detectives back into the home and she signed the form. Boom, consent. So now they had to call in backup to like conduct this whole search.
Yeah.
So backup had arrived. McVetty, John Golub Sr., and a uniformed officer were making their way through the house, and they started making their way into the basement. And McVetty was absolutely shocked at the amount of garbage and clutter all over the place, especially in the basement. He would later tell the jury that the basement was so cluttered it, quote-unquote, hampered their investigation.
Wow.
Yeah. And once they were in the basement, McVetty spotted a small door in the basement that was blocked by a large steamer trunk, which prompted him to ask, like, what the fuck that was about. Now, John, like the father, told the officers that the trunk was just for storage. And they were like, okay, like, can we move it? And he was like, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So they move it. And once they did, McVetty kind of shined his flashlight into the darkness. And the light showed that there was a large green sleeping bag that was zippered.
Oh, no.
And propped really awkwardly against the wall, almost like there was something inside.
Oh, God.
They approached the bag, and they noticed that it had actually come unzipped near the bottom, and partially poking out of it was a pale and bloody human leg.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Now, McVetti immediately secured the scene and called in homicide detectives. The news of the search had already made its way around the neighborhood, and a ton of the neighbors on Horton Road had come out to their yards and their driveways to see what was going on, including Richard and Victoria Tinius. So, not wanting the news to reach them before he could, McVetti literally made a beeline to this couple so he could tell them himself what had happened.
Oh, God.
And Victoria just started screaming.
Oh, my God. Like, how do you even?
I have, like, chills all over my body right now. I can't imagine. And I don't even want to. Like,
no one should ever imagine that.
I just want to give, like, her parents the biggest hug because they look like New Englanders.
They
like,
do. I was just looking at pictures of them and I was just like, oh, my God, they're breaking my heart.
They just look like your friend's parents.
Yeah, they really do.
You know?
And, like, who care?
Yeah.
A lot.
And, like, you would go over their house and, like, like talk to them while you were hanging out with your friend, you know? Like,
that kills me.
You're just, like, everyday people.
Yeah.
And something absolutely fucking horrible happened. No, Siri, are you kidding me right now?
Man, Siri.
Oh, she comes at the worst times.
So fucking rude, Siri.
That really was.
Okay. Jesus.
Back to the seriousness.
That was till, I think that was, like, something was, like, hey, break the tension real quick.
Honestly.
It's getting deep.
Honestly.
But here we are, we're back.
And we're back. So Detective Lane arrived at the Golub house around noon that same day and spoke to Elizabeth and John Sr. while they waited for the medical examiner to arrive.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Now, followed by an interview with John Jr., And he told Detective Lane that he got home from school the previous day at the usual time, and he had two friends with him, Mick Donnell.
Ooh.
Pause for lols.
Okay.
Literally Mick Donnell.
Who did that?
Why you do?
Why'd you do that?
And Chris Earl. Fine.
Okay, that's fine.
So he said they played Nintendo for a while. Sign of the times.
Well, I was just going to say.
And then they hung out with older brother Robert for a bit until he went back up to his bedroom. And when he went back upstairs, they said they went and played basketball not long after.
Okay.
According to John Jay, he returned home a little bit after 5 that night. So the crime scene search unit arrived at the house a little after 1 p.m. and they began what would be an exhausting documentation and search of the basement. The fact that there was so much garbage and clutter spread everywhere just made it way more difficult. So by the time the medical examiner, Dr. Lone Fanning, arrived an hour later, detectives had pulled the sleeping bag out from the closet and carefully laid it out on the basement floor. And when they moved the sleeping bag, Lane and his partner discovered a pile of lace curtains that were soaked in blood.
Oh.
And also a large World War I era bayonet lying in a pool of blood next to the curtains.
What? A bayonet?
Yes.
What the fuck?
And here's the thing. This medical examiner is a suburban medical examiner. And I just told you there's been like one murder in the past 10 years.
Oh, man. Now there's a bayonet involved?
Yeah. Dr. Jesus. Thanning was used to just like natural cause deaths, yeah. you know, and was shocked by what she discovered upon opening the sleeping bag. This is absolutely brutal. Just so you know, like if you do Very need graphic. To skip, please do. One of the detectives on the case would later say that Kelly's remains were scarcely recognizable as human.
Oh my God.
Whatever happened to her and the person that did this, like, I'm like, you're not even a human. You're an animal.
Oh God.
An animal. Her face had been beaten and was insanely bruised by the time she was discovered. Her throat had been cut so severely that the wound extended, quote unquote, nearly to her backbone.
Oh my God.
And clumps of her hair had been ripped from her scalp in what appeared to be handfuls.
What the fuck?
And then detectives also discovered in the bag a bra that had been knotted, like it had been used as a choking device.
She's 13 years old.
13 years old.
Oh my God.
Now, at a quick glance, her body suffered the same brutality as her face, if not more.
Oh.
Her torso, she head to toe is just covered in bruises, slashes, two human bite marks.
Oh my God.
And this is super graphic and absolutely fucking awful. Her killer had slit her from sternum to groin, exposing her internal organs.
Oh my God.
Like, horrific.
Medical examiner.
I have to wonder if that was like the last case they ever did.
I can't.
I would have to have had retired after that.
How do you couldn't prepare for that in a city setting?
No.
Never mind in like a suburban.
Just like in this quiet little street where like everybody.
Oh my God.
It really was a quiet little street. Everybody gets along. Like, and she just got a call like, come over.
Oh no.
How many times did you get a call when you were younger to go to your neighbor's house?
What the fuck happened?
Now,
holy shit.
Going back to the scene, a lot of the cuts made to Kelly's torso were consistent with a blade that was the size and shape of the bayonet.
Jesus.
But also at the same time, many of them were not consistent with the bayonet.
Oh.
Which led detectives to believe that there was a second or possibly even third weapon missing from the scene. Detective Lane had seen the body when they pulled it from beneath the basement stairs, and he theorized that whoever had done this to Kelly had to be a very large, very powerful person.
And very vicious, awful, savage person.
Mm-hmm. Now, he'd seen John Jay, who was average height and weight build for a 14-year-old boy, and he assumed his two friends were, you know, most likely of a similar build. So it seemed very unlikely that any of those three were responsible.
Yeah.
Possible, but not likely. So based on all the testimony collected that day, the only people in the house that previous afternoon were John Jay, those two friends, and 21-year-old bodybuilder Robert. Bodybuilder. So Detective Jack Sharkey was assigned the task of interviewing McDonnell and Chris Earle, John Jay's two friends, who had been at the house that afternoon. They confirmed that they had all been there, and just like John Jay said, they played video games before they left to go play basketball. And they also suggested it was pretty likely that it was John who called Kelly and invited her over to the house.
Wow.
Officers had learned that the boy had, quote unquote, been sweet on Kelly for years.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And he was the only one in the house that really knew her that day.
My God.
No, after their interview, both boys actually consented to a polygraph test, and they both passed, quote unquote, with flying colors.
Wow.
So because they didn't really match, like, who they thought could have, like, overpowered Kelly and pair that hand in hand with the passing of the lie detector test, it rules them out as suspects.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Since Donald and Earl were now crossed off the list of suspects, the only two remaining possibilities were John and Robert. But again, since he seemed to lack the physical strength they thought would have been necessary, and since his friends had confirmed that John Jay had been with them that afternoon, Detective Lane decided to focus his attention on the older brother, Robert. Now, according to Robert, he had woken up around 10 a.m. because he's a real winner.
Yeah.
On the morning of the 3rd.
He's really killing it.
He's really killing the game. And he said he went to a convenience store to purchase a bodybuilding magazine.
Cool.
Because apparently he was very fixated on his one hobby in life.
He's so cool.
Yeah, like wicked cool. And then after he got his magazine, he came right back home, he said.
I doubt it.
Who even knows? So that afternoon, he spent time with his brother, his brother's friends, and he said after the younger boys left to play basketball, he went back up to his room, he drank a couple of beers and smoked some weed. And he said that he had never seen or spoken to Kelly that afternoon. And in fact, he really only knew her well enough anyways to say hi. It's like, weird. Why was she in your house then?
I totally believe you.
But he did say that Kelly had been close with his younger brother, John, and that she, quote, sometimes called the Golub home twice a day to speak to John Jay.
Okay.
So I do wonder if there was like a little bit of like flirtation going
on between
John Jay and Kelly.
Yeah.
I don't think John Jay had anything to do with this, to be honest, in my personal opinion. I don't know, but I don't think so.
Okay.
So when police showed Robert the bayonet used in the attack on Kelly, he said he never owned it and had actually never seen it before. And as far as he knew, nobody in the house did either.
Oh, a bayonet just showed up in your house one day?
A World War I bayonet, just like essentially an antique. You just plop, it fell in your house.
You know, I can't believe that has happened to somebody else.
That happened to you too,
yeah, huh? It just showed up in my house.
Like, who do you think you're fooling, Robert?
Like, you're really looking at investigators and being like,
never seen it.
It doesn't belong to anybody in this house. It just lives here.
Yeah, it's just...
It pays rent. I don't know.
Just showed
it
up.
It doesn't belong
day.
To us.
Like, what?
What?
What, dude?
It's a bay of fucking net.
It's a World War
I-hour
era bayonet.
That is a relic of years past, and you are telling me that you don't know how it ended up in your house?
Lies.
Liar.
So, weirdly, he consented to a polygraph examination. He was like, yeah, I'll take that.
Arrogance. He thought he could beat it.
He sure did. He had full-on plans to do that because they did go on with the test, but it had to be called off partway through when the examiner noticed that Robert was trying to mess with the results by holding his breath at various points.
Of course he was.
You don't think the examiner is not going to see you holding your breath?
Their entire job
is to
read every single little thing that sets your body off to make it that you're lying. And you think that holding your breath is going to somehow get past them?
It's an examiner. They examine you.
They just watch your ass.
Boy.
You dumb fuck.
I'm glad you're dumb, but like, shit. So while detectives interviewed the rest of the neighbors on Horton Road, the crime scene technicians continued this absolutely crazy job.
Oh my God, the daunting task.
Daunting task, because this scene is brutal anyways, and then the added chaos of the crime scene.
Oh.
Now, while they were searching, there were a few significant items found in the basement. There were two briefcases that contained Kelly's clothes that she was wearing the day before. Random briefcases.
Fuck? That's so weird.
And a large white t-shirt that appeared to have 4 semen stains on the front of it.
Disgusting.
I'll tell you now, they don't think she was sexually assaulted.
Well, that's good.
Pre-mortem?
Like, perimortem? Like perimortem?
Yeah, perimortem. Now, each of the briefcases had some blood smeared on the outside and on the inside, but it was going to take some time to determine whether that had come from Kelly or her killer. So they had their work laid out.
Damn.
Now, the autopsy was performed the following day, and actually there was a few people in attendance. There was Detective Richard Wells, the medical examiner Dr. Thanning, a serologist named Dr. Arlene Colin, and then the chief medical examiner Dr. Leslie Lukash.
Mm-hmm.
Now, thankfully, like I was just saying, tests actually found no evidence of semen on the surface of Kelly's body or internally.
And there was
no other signs of sexual assault.
Okay, so pre-mortem she was, or perimortem, either one, she was not.
She was not.
Okay.
Now, unfortunately, though, the medical examiner wasn't able to find any fingerprints present on the body, which is, I'm like, did you wash her?
I know.
Down?
How
like,
did that what? Work?
But I don't, maybe it was because it was so brutal.
Yeah.
But the chief medical examiner, Dr. Lukash, determined the cause of death was blunt force trauma to the skull. But after identifying more than 200, and this is in quotes, 200 discrete blows to her head, the medical examiner had to stop counting.
200?
More than 200.
My brain isn't computing that. I don't even know how that's possible.
The randomness of this act is just like, I don't know if maybe that's why it's one of the most requested cases. It's like, Like, how did this happen?
I'm, like, speechless. Like, 200.
Had to stop counting at 200.
To her head.
Yeah. Like, I don't even know.
Poor girl.
How you do that.
What kind of fucking savage animal do you have to be?
And, like, exactly. Like, that is animalistic behavior.
That is, that's not even of this world. Like, no. I can't even.
That's not.
Comprehend.
That's not even, like, demonic. That kind
of, yeah, that's like, I'm like, what the
I can't even
fuck?
Think of a creature that I know of that could do that to another person.
To just, like, that is so long. Yeah. Think about hitting something 200 times, how long that takes.
No, I can't imagine.
Just think about, like, taking your hand and hitting a table 200 times.
No.
How long that would take and how much energy that would take eventually.
Hours.
Like, that is, I'm speechless. That's I don't even know what to say about that. That's unbelievable.
It's absolutely
that
crazy.
Poor girl.
I know. And that her poor family.
Her family. I just,
it's awful. I actually, like, have anxiety right now.
I know.
It's, like,
that's
a lot.
Like, really killing me.
So based on the evidence collected at the scene, Lukasz believed that the blunt force trauma was consistent with the antique rifle found at the scene, but said that the extent of the damage was too great to ever be positive.
Wow.
She said, I think so, but I mean, you get to 200 blows, you can't fit an instrument there. Like, you don't know what that was after a certain point.
Because you're not even seeing distinct, like, wounds at that point. Like, oh my God.
Now, the slicing wound to the neck, was a match for the bayonet. But there also appeared to be an indentation, and this is, again, brutal, an indentation near the wound that until then couldn't be accounted for. Like, they were trying to figure out what that was. So the doctor spent more time examining the blade and then realized that the circular indentation was caused by the knob on the handle of the knife, which meant that the killer had to, quote unquote, lay the blade across Kelly's throat and then stand the full weight of his body on the knife, bouncing up and down. You have to.
I have never heard anything like this.
Never in my entire life. And you have to hope. And you, like, I have to, like, tell myself that she was gone.
She had to have been.
With
she
the blows to the head, she had to dead. Have been.
It had to have been, which does not fix any of this, but it, my God, I can't.
Who does, like, we have covered some of the worst of
Holy
the worst
shit.
Of the worst. And I cannot compare this killer to anyone I have ever read about.
This is just like,
like, my arms this entire time are
this
just covered.
This is stuff you can't make up.
No.
Like, this is stuff that if you saw it in a horror movie, you'd be like, who comes up with that?
You'd be like, I don't, like, want to watch anything
you'd
by
you'd
this
just
person
like,
ever
no one
again.
Is like, no one's like that.
No.
Oh, my God.
No.
Oh, poor Kellyanne. Oh.
And her family.
Yeah,
to know that
this.
Your baby went
oh,
through
God.
This.
Oh, honestly, like, my,
I know.
I just want to hug her
Remove
parents.
It. So I'm like, think I said that. So when the examination was complete, Dr. Lukasz concluded that Kelly's murder had to have been committed by somebody in a frenzy.
Yeah, to say the least.
Yep. And could only have been done by a quote unquote incredibly fit and powerful man.
Jesus.
So given the amount of evidence collected at the scene and the story being told by Kelly's body, Detective Lane and Wells kept their attention focused on the most obvious suspect, Robert Golub, right? No, Golub, damn it.
Golub.
He was brought into the station at this point for question, or even before that, he was brought into the station for questioning actually on the afternoon that the body was discovered.
Oh, wow.
This all happened very quickly.
I was going to say, this probably happened so fast.
Mm-hmm. So John and Elizabeth had been cooperating with police up to this point, but now a lawyer for the family had instructed the two brothers to refrain from answering any questions beyond the statements they'd already given to the police.
Damn.
So days passed without an arrest, and the public was starting to grow anxious that there might literally never be another resolution. And Kelly's parents, Richard and Victoria, must have been losing their goddamn minds.
Seriously.
Because you know what happened. She went into that house. She was found there. So why hasn't somebody been arrested
exactly.
yet? I would have been like,
oh my God, I'd be losing my fucking mind.
And they were. Now, in the meantime, forensic tests were being conducted and the results, I mean, remember, this is the 80s. The results were very slow to return. But when they did come, they seemed to confirm that Robert was involved in the killing. But there were complications. For one thing, there was a handprint discovered near the body that did belong to Robert, but it was discovered in his home, which made it a lot less significant. And then the blood smears on the cases where Kelly's clothes had been found were also determined to be Robert's blood. But given that, again, it was his home, there was no way for analysts to determine whether it was left there the day of the killing or a day or two before. Like,
yeah,
I don't know who would think that that got left there a day or two before,
but sure,
to bring it to court, you got to go beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, when Robert was brought in for questioning on the day of the murder, he actually had several small cuts on his right hand.
Oh.
But those cuts, they said, showed no signs of having bled recently.
Hmm.
Which is weird, but I'm like, I mean, how do you really determine that? Like, if he has cuts on his hand, he has cuts on his hand.
Yeah, he does.
Right?
Like, yeah.
How can you tell if they bled recently, if they're red?
I mean, you could really, the only thing I can think of is, like, what stage of healing they're in.
Mm.
That's really all I could.
Yeah.
Say about that, I guess. I don't really know.
Because I'm like, they didn't like, were they open cuts? Like, if they're open cuts, like,
are they
then
scabbed over cuts? Because then you could be like,
they're healing. Right.
They're in the process of healing.
But the way they put it is no signs of having recently bled. I'm like, that's a weird standard.
Yeah, it's like he would have washed that.
Right, exactly. So essentially, while he may have looked very guilty, a good lawyer could have explained a bulk of the physical evidence as to being no different than skin cells, fingerprints, and trace fluids that everybody leaves around their house every day, which is really gross that you
it
like.
It really is gross.
I'm like, oh. That. Do you struggle to save money every month? Well, with Rocket Money, you can quickly identify all those sneaky subscriptions that keep charging you month after month and cancel any you no longer use. It's such an easy way to start saving money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps you lower your bills all in one place. I know, isn't that the most ideal thing you've ever heard in your life? Well, with Rocket Money, you can easily cancel those subscriptions that you don't want with just the press of a button. No more long hold times or annoying emails with customer service that you wait forever for someone to get back to you. No, no, no. Rocket Money does all of that work for you. And Rocket Money can even negotiate to lower your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is take a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money also lets you monitor all of your expenses in one place, recommends custom budgets based on your past spending, and it'll even send you notifications when you've reached your spending limits. That personally has been so helpful for me because, you know, your girl loves to treat herself and sometimes she treats herself a little too much, but then Rocket Money is like, hey, girly, slow down. So with over 5 million users and counting, Rocket Money has helped save its customers an average of $720 a year and $1 billion in total savings so far. Whoa! Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions and manage your money the easy way by going to rocketmoney.com/morbid. That's rocketmoney.com/morbid. rocketmoney.com/morbid. But on March 24th, nearly 3 weeks after Kelly's body had been discovered in the basement, investigators did finally feel like they had enough evidence to make an arrest, and Robert was arrested.
Wow.
Now, it was a step in the right direction, but still people in the community were pissed off, like they were very frustrated. Kelly's uncle Robert told the press, "We feel only a fraction of relief about the arrest. There are so many unanswered questions that are hurting right now. 4 people in the house and no one heard anything."
Yeah. That's what's so shocking to me. I'm like, what the fuck is going on in that house?
No one heard anything?
Yeah.
Like, is the basement soundproof?
That kind of beating?
But then you think about the loud music and I'm like,
oh, the loud music. That
is that why nobody heard anything? Because it was so loud that Richie could hear it outside.
Oh my God. That adds such a different layer to this.
It's like a horror film.
It is. This is like so bad.
It is. So those unanswered questions and frustrations grew exponentially in the time between the arrest and the trial. While Robert spent his days in prison, he was like lifting weights in the yard or preparing in his cell for trial. A lot was going on back home. Reporters, neighbors, strangers were harassing John and Elizabeth Golub nonstop. Their home was being referred to as a murder house because that's what it was. And their harassment had actually become so intense that they had to send John Jay off to a private boarding school.
Oh, wow.
Which if he had nothing to do with this, then yeah, you do feel bad that that
of
happened.
Of course.
It's just so weird. And then Kelly's family claimed that the at the same time that the Golubs were trying to intimidate them. And then the Golubs claimed that they were being prevented from freely coming and going to their home. And Elizabeth claimed that actually she was being sexually harassed around town at this point. So it is a whole full-blown mess.
Yeah.
Like, it is like the neighbors that hate each other. The you know, it's oldest time.
Oh, the Hatfields and McCoys.
Thank you. Yes. It's that, literally.
I loved that little, like, hand motion you were doing.
I knew it would get
just,
you.
Just flowy hands. And I was like, got it.
You were like, I don't know what you're saying. The Hatfields and the McCoys.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly what this
was. That makes sense.
And eventually the tension had become so disruptive, like fights had broken out and everything, that a police officer had to be regularly parked on Horton Road to intervene if necessary.
Wow.
It got that bad, which is sad. And yeah, you can understand why it got that bad.
Of course.
Now, while all of that was going on in the neighborhood, Robert's defense lawyer, John Lewis, he was hard at work trying to get a ton of critical evidence excluded from trial.
Of course.
Yeah. Prior to trial, a Fry hearing was held to determine whether the DNA evidence collected at the scene, mostly from the outside of the briefcases and the palm print on the wall.
Okay.
They wanted to see it in this trial if it would be allowed at the murder trial. Now, for those that don't know, because I didn't know, a Fry hearing, according to Cornell Law School, quote, determines the admissibility of an expert's scientific testimony and other types of evidence. So back then, you weren't seeing a lot of cases where DNA was being.
Yeah.
In fact, Kelly's was actually one of the first cases in America where DNA was used.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Isn't that
That's
crazy?
That's interesting.
Now, so they had to have that hearing to see like what was going to be admissible and what wasn't.
Okay.
So John Lewis argued that DNA science was still in its infancy and it was unreliable.
Oh.
DNA evidence.
Didn't know.
But the prosecution presented several experts who testified that, quote, DNA fingerprinting is a reliable scientific theory that is generally accepted in the scientific community, and that the six-step procedure used to extract and analyze DNA samples is also generally accepted in the scientific community.
I love this, that they're like, DNA is generally accepted in the scientific community.
They're like, so there.
Yeah, it feels all right.
So there were more pretrial hearings that took place in mid-August, and the tensions were insanely high. There was a lot of fighting going on between the families. There
Can't
were fights
why.
Within the courtroom. I would be throwing hands.
Oh, yeah, I'd be furious.
People had to be escorted out. And then more problems were to come in October when the defense attorney, John Lewis, was thrown off the case.
Oh.
So he actually got into an argument with the judge that was presiding over the case, Judge Marvin Goodman. And the defense attorney, Lewis, told the judge that he wasn't prepared to go to trial that month and he wanted to push out to January to get to have more time to prepare.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Who gives a shit about the families that have to sit here and deal with this shit?
Thank you. Yeah. Exactly.
Let's push it out because I'm not ready.
I'm not ready. Sorry. It's like, sorry. You've had plenty of time. Yeah. Like, if you don't have a good case, it's because he did it.
Yeah.
The end.
The end.
Also.
So says I.
I would tap my little gavel. But the judge denied that request, basically good. Saying everything that we did and saying he hadn't provided a legal reason for it. So, like.
Yeah.
No.
Just because you're not prepared isn't my fault.
Exactly. That's probably exactly what he said.
Yeah.
But Lewis lost it. He was pissed about that. And he said he wasn't going to be forced to go to trial and that Goodman could hold him in contempt or throw him in jail.
And he's like, got it.
And Goodman was like, I'm not going to do either of those things. You're just not going to work on this case.
Yeah. He's going to go ahead and throw you right off.
You're gone.
Yeah.
And
you're
done. You're done. And he was replaced with Salvatore Marinello. Hopefully I said that right. So Robert's trial for the second degree murder of Kelly Ann began on February 15th, 1990. Yeah. So.
Wow.
And it took place in, I don't have time to look this up, Manola, New York?
Yeah.
Totally. So in opening statements, the prosecutor, Daniel Cotter, laid out the extent of the evidence, including the massive DNA evidence that linked Robert to the murder.
My God.
He also detailed the extent of Kelly's injuries, and he paid particular attention to the mutilation of the genitals and the buttocks.
That's
because
so fucked up.
She had been, like I said,
completely... Oh, just like eviscerated.
Eviscerated.
Yeah.
And one of the bite marks was actually to her backside, like on her bum.
God, you fucking animal.
And happened post-mortem.
Holy shit.
Like, not even an animal. An animal would not do this.
I was just going to say, I don't even know what to compare this fucker to.
And that's the thing. It's like, not even an animal, not even a demon.
Doesn't
like,
exist.
I don't know what to call you.
An entity unto itself. Truly an entity unto itself.
Seriously. So Cotter told the jury, because of all this, it is fair to assume that this is a sexual assault by a male.
Ugh.
Ugh. Then it was the defense's turn. Salvatore told the jury, the prosecution expects you to make judgments through inferences, and basically told the jury that the evidence was highly scientific, very confusing, and they couldn't trust it.
I'm obsessed with the fact that they were like, DNA? This is like a little too sciencey for me, everybody.
This is going to be like biology class, and yeah, you're going to be very confused.
Let's throw that shit right out. We don't need science.
Science.
And facts? Are you guys looking for facts? Fuck that.
Like, what?
No, we don't want scientific facts. And here, there's hard-to-pronounce words.
Yes, of course.
It makes me sad. And like, are you guys, are you all right?
Right,
are
exactly.
Are you kidding me? Science is not a reliable thing in a trial.
Jesus. Can you imagine? Like 1990. That's I'd be what like, people wow, were saying. I was only born idiots. 6 years later.
Jesus.
Like you were
five.
Wow, that's it. I'm like, you're old.
It was 1990, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, five.
And they're literally like, and they're DNA, like, what's that? Like,
sounds gross.
That was in your lifetime.
Yeah. That's what? Upsetting.
Isn't that upsetting?
That's really upsetting.
But like I said, this was a time in America where DNA really hadn't been used in a ton of court cases.
Yeah.
To get a guilty verdict anyways.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
So he was definitely hoping that all this scientific garbage.
Oh, yeah.
Hullabaloo was going to go over the jury's head. But just in case it didn't, he also tried to put doubt in their minds about everybody there that day and told the jury, there were three other boys in the house that day who could have done this, right? They were there right around the time of the murder. I'm like, they are three 14-year-olds. They are all the same size.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Truly.
No. Now, luckily, Prosecutor Cotter there was able to shoot down that argument by pointing out how unlikely it would be for three 14-year-old boys to commit, quote, a savage, vicious act, been covered with blood, and then go calmly play basketball.
Yeah.
Because again, like they literally had an alibi.
Yeah.
And then to prove his point even further that it wasn't one of these younger boys, he explained that one of the boys placed a call to his mom from the Golub house at about 3:21 to go tell her that he and his friends were leaving to play basketball.
Hmm.
So I wonder, because that phone call meant Kelly entered the house shortly after 3:20 p.m., I would say, that she would have been in the house alone with Robert. Yeah. So that makes me wonder, was it John Jay that called, or was it Robert pretending saying he was John Jay, knowing that his brother had been maybe like flirting with Kelly, and they had all gone out to go play basketball, and he saw some kind of opportunity?
That, to me, that makes sense.
Right?
To me, it makes sense that this little fucker would pretend to be his little brother to 100%. Lure her to that house.
That's what I think.
Because I don't know anything about this family. I don't know anything about this pig and his brother.
Uh-uh.
But I don't know if it makes sense that, like, this kid would just lure her there, especially if he liked her.
If he was sweet on her, exactly.
Like they had some kind of thing.
And then he's going to leave. Like, if anything, you would think he would, if he was the one that called her, I feel like, and if she liked him, they would have gone and played basketball together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's straight. And to me, it feels more like this guy pretending.
Yeah, definitely.
Because this agree. Feels cunning as fuck.
That's my theory, yeah. Is that he obviously saw Kelly around town, probably developed some kind of weird fucking fascination. And
because
then
he's a fucking troll.
Oh, he's beyond even.
Pigman.
Beyond words.
True pigman.
Yuccas.
Yeah.
Yuccas McGee. Disgusting. Is the new name.
Truly.
Now, over the course of the next few weeks, jurors were presented with a whole slew of information and evidence. I can't imagine having to sit on this jury.
No.
I can't.
Having to hear about those injuries in real time would be outrageous.
And they did have to, because the medical examiner took the stand to testify about the extent of the injuries and placed the death somewhere between 3:30 and 8:20. I'm thinking it was closer to the 3:20 range, yeah, of things. And the doctor also testified that while a lot of the slice injuries were caused by the rusty bayonet, there were others caused by at least two additional instruments that were unaccounted for. Then another expert, excuse me, the serologist, Dr. Arlene Colon, explained how DNA can be used to trace blood or other fluids back to a single individual.
Okay.
So she explained this to the jury and they were able to comprehend
this. They were able to understand.
Crazy. Now, according to this doctor, the investigators had found several spots of Robert's blood mixed with or adjacent to Kelly's blood, meaning that, quote, Kelly's killer had his own blood on his hands when he was attempting to clean up after Kelly's death.
Which makes sense.
Of course it does.
Like, he's not coming out of there with no scratches on his hands.
Absolutely not. So the analysis of the palm print that was discovered on a piece of crown molding near the basement closet was also a match for Robert. And a crime scene analyst testified that the print was most likely left there very shortly after Kelly was murdered. He probably like leaned up against the wall to move her. So after closing arguments on April 2nd, 1990, the jury deliberated for a full day before returning a verdict of guilty.
Good.
Not even going to make you wait for that.
Good.
When the verdict was read, the courtroom literally erupted into screams and cries from Kelly's family. Like, just, they were so happy, but then that happiness turned to anger. And they were like, it was just way too much for everybody involved.
Yeah, how do you even wrap your brain around it?
So while that was all going on and, like, everybody's, like, trying to figure out even how to feel about this, Robert is just sitting there with literally zero emotion.
Because he's a beast.
He's beyond. Beyond. Oh. Now, he returned to court on June 1st for sentencing. And in a surprising turn of events, 11 of the 12 jurors who sat on the case actually asked to attend the sentencing hearing. They wanted to be there. And so did four of the alternates who had also sat through the trial. They wanted to see this motherfucker sentenced.
Holy, I don't blame them.
The court also received over 1,000 letters from the public demanding that he be sentenced to life in prison.
Wow.
So he was given the opportunity to speak before he was sentenced.
Which I'll never understand why we let that happen.
Me either. And he did take the chance to say that he was innocent.
Shut the fuck up.
That's weird that your blood was everywhere then.
Yeah, that's strange.
And he told the jury, I did not kill Kelly Antinous. Who let Kelly into our home? Who could have had any motive? These are questions I have to answer. These are questions the jury should have considered.
Oh, okay.
You really thought you
scold
did something
the jury,
there.
Like, for sure.
He then went on to scold the jury. He said that there was a police conspiracy to convict him. The jury was against him. They hadn't behaved properly. The crime scene technicians and analysts who had processed the scene were also all out to get him.
Nobody cares that much about you, my friend.
No. So when he finished with that load of malarkey, the Judge Goodman, who I love, told him, the acts which you committed in this case are by far the most atrocious that I have ever experienced in my 17 years as a judge.
Truly.
And the manner in which you killed Kelly Antinous and mutilated her body surpasses the worst murders known to this county.
Yeah.
No dictionary contains sufficient words to describe the brutality of your acts. Unfortunately, the sentence option given to me by all of our laws falls short of the sentence which you truly deserve. You are hereby sentenced to a maximum term of life and to a minimum term of 25 years.
Which is, would not even be slightly enough.
So 25 years to life. Jeez. Like, not enough.
No.
Now, Robert appealed his conviction in 1993, thinking that that was really going to move anybody. It didn't. He said it was on the grounds that the evidence was mishandled, the analysis of the DNA was improper, because he knows how to do that.
Oh, yeah.
And the, that was just it. But the appeals court upheld the conviction.
Good.
Now, he maintained his innocence until his case came up for consideration by the parole board in 2013. And he had a hearing. Yeah. And he finally confessed to the murder.
Oh, shit.
And he said that he had killed Kellyanne, quote, in a rage due to his use of a ridiculous amount of anabolic steroids.
I knew it.
Yep.
I knew it.
But, like, I've seen people on steroids. You've seen people on steroids. That is more than just steroids. You have a beast that lives inside of you.
I was just going to say.
That was then fed those steroids.
That was fed those steroids. That's a perfect way of saying it.
Exactly.
It is very much already inside of you.
100%.
It is inside every cell in your body that you were able to do that.
Anabolic steroids
did not cause you to do that.
No.
They allowed that beast to come out.
Exactly.
That's all it was.
Exactly. He claimed that he never meant to kill her. Which,
shut
like,
shut the fuck
thank you
up,
thank
Robert. You. Shut the fuck up.
The extent of her injuries. Oh my God. And you never meant to kill her?
I want to put a boot in your fucking face. Are you kidding me? You never meant to kill her? Shut the fuck up.
Like, go back to your tiny little cell.
Say nothing.
And spend the rest of your days remembering what you did to her, knowing full well that you are going to a place that is literally worse than hell.
I hope she haunts you until the minute you die.
Every single second.
Truly.
Of every single day.
I hope Kelly haunts you.
He said he was remorseful.
Oh, shut the fuck up.
I bet the fuck you are, because you want to get out of prison.
You don't exist. You're not a real thing.
No.
You don't have the same shit that everybody else does. Remorse is not, it's a vocabulary word to you. It's not a feeling.
If you can do that to a human,
no.
There is no part of me that believes you are capable of remorse.
No.
Not one part of me that believes that.
Absolutely not.
No. Luckily, state parole officials were as unconvinced as we are, and Robert has since been denied parole on two different occasions.
I hope they tell him to go fuck himself every single time.
I don't think they're allowed to, but they probably say it as he walks out.
Literally, as he walked out, I'd be like, don't forget, Robert,
go fuck yourself
every single time. Oh, remember last time? Go fuck yourself if you haven't done it yet.
Yep.
Go fuck yourself, Robert.
Literally into oblivion.
I hate this pig.
This the is worst, one of the worst.
The most brutal.
Ever.
I think I can, I mean, that is.
That I don't think I could ever cover another case like this.
Oh.
Now, in the year since Kelly's murder, her parents, Richard and Victoria, they hold a celebration on her birthday, March 5th, every single year to remember her. And still, their neighbors from Horton Road join them. And now it's gone, like, way above and beyond that. Like, people join all the time.
Amazing.
And from all over. And in 2021, they had a memorial unveiled at a park in Valley Stream, which honors the memory of Kelly.
Oh, I love that.
Now, Robert remains in prison. He still hopes that he's going to get some kind of parole. He's not going to.
I hope you slowly rot.
But Richard and Victoria and countless other members of Valley Stream are locked and loaded with victim impact statements and letters demanding he remain in prison. In the interest of public safety.
Yeah.
Like, not only just for their peace of mind, like not wanting to see him ever again.
But he should never be allowed around people. Ever again.
If you can do that one time, I can't fucking imagine what you would do if you, like, didn't live in your parents' house and were left to your own devices.
Yes, I can't even
fathom. Because you did that in your parents' home.
Well, that's what's wild to me.
Just went down to the basement.
No, I can't.
What
I literally can't.
Fuck. So that is the tragic, tragic, tragic case of Kelly Antinous.
I am speechless.
It was very hard to get through. I you just remember being 13, and I can't imagine that happening to anybody I knew at 13 years old.
13 is a baby. That is.
She was just about to, 2 days later, she would have been 14.
Oh, and right before her birthday. And it's just like, that family, I can't. And her poor little brother.
That's the thing. And then to have to go on and be okay for Richie.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Oh.
I can't imagine. But they seem the most amazing people. They really do.
Oh, I just want to give them a hug.
I know.
That's awful.
Yeah, it was a brutal case. I think, were you going to do something spooky?
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to follow this up with something. Maybe a spooky
haunting.
Road.
Or lake, or
lake, or something. You'll know, obviously, but it's there'll be something.
Maybe
in
another
there,
haunted school. I think we have a whole folder of those.
Yeah, we got a lot of those. So we'll follow it up with just one spooky.
Yeah,
haven't done one in a while.
Just a little palate cleanser, if you will.
Yeah, we're due for one.
Yeah.
Feels right. Feels good, especially after this.
I need
a minute. Yeah. So
I need a beat.
Yeah, I need a beat.
You know.
Oy. So look out for that.
And with that being said, guys, we hope you keep listening.
And we hope you
keep
it
weird. You know I'm not saying anything.
No.
That's it.
Nope.
That's a wrap.
Bye.
Goodbye. Love you guys.
Hope you have a great day.
If you like Morbid, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.